I want to give credit to my old Dutch father that even though once he didn't talk to me for 2 weeks, we worked together, that was because I slid my four-cylinder Henderson motorcycle in the basement, and the smell of the gasoline bugged him so bad he couldn't sleep. He had asthma. And if he was here now, I'd tell him that nobody ever died from insomnia, but I didn't talk back to him then. You know, even in those years when my dad and I lived alone, he would reach under the homemade table and read the Bible after every meal and give God credit that we did have three meals most days. And I estimated that when I left home on a 28 Harley, I'd probably heard over 20,000 chapters read from the Bible, and that stood me in good stead in later years as it does today. This morning my reading was in Ezekiel for I forget how many years that Evie and I have been reading our Bibles through year by year, and it was my practice in some small churches to give people a chart from the NAE. I would get 100 of them every year and encourage people to read through their Bible. And that way, if I came up with some far-fetched illustration on Wednesday night, well, they'd been reading it too, and they knew wherever I spake. And I must, first of all, warn you of my sense of humor, but you didn't know me before I had one. I went to Biola for one semester in 1940, and one of the students met me as I was going to work at Health Cafeteria and said, and I quote, "Cheer up, John, maybe it won't happen." And I must confess that I had a one-track mind. Automobiles make two tracks, but motorcycles just make one. And the fact that I had a one-track mind kept me from really entering into the studies at Biola, but I made a lot of friends there, and when they came back from the mission fields, I had entered the ministry through the back door, and I could invite them to speak in our church. And if we've had any success in the ministry, it's been because we've had mission-centered churches and have been interested in missions and missionaries, and we still are. I'm not sure how this is going to work out. When I really got turned on for the Lord, I didn't feel it was right for me to use a crude concordance. I thought, I've got to find these scriptures and remember where they are. And I think in the long run that was a benefit. To this day I don't have a computer. I do have a number of concordances, but mainly when I need something in the Word, I like to go looking for it. And this morning in my reading in Ezekiel, it was talking about some wheels. And I thought, my, how appropriate that is in my particular case. You know where I was a week ago today? A week ago right now, I was up by the by the Canadian border, and we have a lot of fun with the Canadians. For a while, we thought you had to have a blue license plate to shop in Bellingham, but the Canadians come now to fill their gas tanks, just as we used to go there, and we have a San Juan Island sports car. That's a pickup truck, and we'd go across the line and fill both gas tanks, and that way we could save enough money to pay for the ferry trip. And these Canadians come down, and I hope they don't tell as many jokes about us as the people on our side. They call us Americans, and, you know, they live in America, too. We recently heard that they were hard up for a name for their country, and so they dumped all the anagrams in the dishpan, shook them up, and the governor pulled them out, one letter at a time. C, eh? N, eh? D, eh? Well, a week ago today, I went to work for a good Christian friend and got there at 7:30. He lives right up on practically on the Canadian line. Married a Canadian, and He said, well, before you start this big welding job, one of our bulldozers is up there on the North Pass Road, and I wish you'd go up there. There's a man wants to fall some trees on this weekend, and would you go up and clear a bunch of blackberries? And he's got 35 acres, so it doesn't matter where you push him, and you'll find the key down there on the blade. Sure enough, I found the key, and he just paid $65,000 for that bulldozer and let me go up and learn how to run it. And I mean, I really have a ball when the wheels go around, like Ezekiel. It's just a wonderful thing to have friends that trust you that much. Now, in the book Doss, it mentions Bremerton, and that's before Bremerton was rated as number one in the country as a place to live. How they got from 147 up to number one is beyond me, and we've lived there three times. But on the 3rd of July in 1940, I started my apprenticeship as a boilermaker. And I'd taken a civil service exam, and the place where I worked, I'd been down praying that I'd get a raise in pay. And I got $17.75 a week for delivering with a motorcycle in Seattle, downtown, and left bits of my elbows here and there. And I thought if I prayed for $5 a week increase, I could go back to Biola in the fall. And right then they rang me and said I had a call to go to work in Bremerton for $5 less per week. And so I started my apprenticeship, and I had been, as I say, to Biola for one semester. And there I met Heber Richens and Herb Bess. They lived across the hall from me on the third floor. And they had a nice note on their door. It says, withdraw thy foot from thy neighbor's house, lest he weary of thee and so hate thee. So we didn't visit as much then as we do now. And then there was Harvey Myrick and Steve Watkins and Virgil Hook and Dick DeLong, who were going to school there, and a number of others. I saw Doug Anderson and Bob Zimmerman. Bob and Betty are our neighbors about a mile away and very, very active at the Furs Conference Grounds after their 32 years in Zaire. Well, I wasn't in Bremerton long before I learned that there was a Tuesday night class up in the YMCA. How many of you knew Jim Forster? Okay. He kept a little file on every sailor he got acquainted with, and I won't tell you what he wrote about Ed Goodrick. You ask him when we get to glory. And anyway, Jim's wife, Dorothy, died several years ago, and one of my relatives checked up on him recently. He's in a rest home. He was a typesetter on the Bellingham Sun, and he lost his hearing. The old lead typesetting machines were hard on the ears, so Jim hasn't heard much for a long time, but I did furnish him a whole set of the tapes that they made of us here in 1985. I can still recall going to those meetings where Jim would ask somebody to lead some choruses. How many of you knew Claude Knuckles? Well, Claude Knuckles was about 5'18", and he'd always say, can we sing I'm So Happy? And we would. And then I learned a lot from John Newman bringing a message there on the New Mexico and how it followed the shape of Noah's Ark. And I met Ken Waters there and Wayne Snell. And Curtis Carter, how many of you knew him? Oh, both of us knew him well. One time I took him down to Fort Lewis on my motorcycle and we visited the service center there. And he said, the thing I like about Trotman, when he gets a message, he pulls it out of the closet. Now, if I didn't learn anything else from Curtis Carter, that helped me. Luella said he had witnessed a murder when he was 11, and he was headed for the slammer shortly thereafter, so he joined the Navy. And I don't know what became of him. But for many, many years, I remembered when I needed a message for my adult class or morning church or young people's meeting or evening service or Wednesday night or Tuesday night or a funeral, that Curtis Carter said, well, Doss got the messages out of the closet. And it was beneficial to me to read Matthew 6 and find that our personal dealings with the Lord are what really bring the results. Well, I got acquainted with Howard Davis and Francis Cole. You remember he went down into California. With Orrin Bell, I remember when I was going to crank up my sickle and he said, quote me Matthew 4:4. I shall not tempt the Lord thy God. And I remember Clifford Burton. You remember that nice picture of him sitting across the desk from Dawson in that magazine in 1941 when they did the article on the Navigators? I liked Clifford Burton, a great guy. And Gordon Gustafson, I've lost track of him. Well, I tried to call him there last year, and he wasn't in the phone book, so he must have an unlisted number, but I'd like to see him again. He was a great help to me. Art Snuggs bought a motorcycle at my place, and then when he got transferred after wrecking it and leaving it at Luella's, he wrote to me that I could have the privilege of buying it, which I did. And Art got a nice new Indian, so shiny you couldn't take pictures of it. It was reflected too much. And he cracked it up and got a nicer one. And then Luella wrote to me that he had hit a fence near his home and was killed. Of course, there was Jim Downing, Fred Hartman, Ivan Lewis, and various other people, including a couple fellows off the British war spite. One was a British Marine who joined up when he was 14, and he'd had a couple ships shot out from under him. And, you know, there were civilians came there too, like John Gaby, Al Inglis, Don Bruner, Mako Allison, who is married to my wife's twin sister. I have a picture to prove it. And, you know, there was a little guy who used to come up there on Tuesday nights. Maybe some of you fellas remember him. He held his Bible about like this. And he was, I guess, legally and practically blind. And he walked as though he were stepping over a furrow one step at a time. A little short fellow named Joe Craig. He's in a retirement home in northeast Seattle now. And we see him going slowly past our daughter's home. And he recognizes our voices yet. Would you believe he's, I guess, around 80. And he teaches Bible in some retirement homes in Seattle. But the little guy used to come up to us and he'd say, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? Some people say one thing, some say another. What do you believe? So he got some of his training Tuesday nights up there in the YMCA from some of you fellas. Now, among these civilians, Dawson met with three or four of us in Jim Forrester's home one night. Somewhere about September, October, somewhere along there, 1940. He said the night before he had been to a young people's meeting, I think in University Presbyterian Church. Said there were approximately 90 or 100 young people there, college students. And he said, how many of you can give me a verse with references? All I'm asking for is just one a month for 1940. How many of you can stand up and give me 10? And he said, only one of those sharp young people could do it, he said, and he came with me. And then he laid upon us Deuteronomy 6, 5, and 6. How many times do you think I had heard my dad read that when I was a boy? Every few years, you know. But the next day, I was waiting for Al Inglis. We waited for each other various times. My wife's here. I waited for her 22 years once. And Al, I had ridden to work with him in his car, and all day long in the boiler shop, Deuteronomy 6:6 had been hammering on me. There were many, many hammers, lots of pneumatic tools going on around. But God says in Jeremiah, is not my word like a fire and like a hammer that breaketh the rock in pieces And this part about these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, I'd had to memorize for catechism in the Dutch church, and I'd had to memorize for personal work at Biola, and so on. But, you know, I reached behind the seat in Al's car, and there was a Bible up there, and believe it or not, I was able to find Deuteronomy 6:6. They say the fastest thing on feet is a cheetah, but a cheetah cannot keep up with a Navy Yard pipe fitter when the whistle blows. And actually, while I waited for Al to come from the joiner shop, I found Deuteronomy 6:6, and that turned me on as far as assimilating and taking in the word for myself. Now, I must mention the Dunamis Club. We met at 6 o'clock in the morning in the YMCA. We called it the Unearthly Hour because we were having a heavenly time, the four of us. And, you know, that was quite an experience. If you read the book Doss, it says that reporting the Dunamis Club was a chore. Now, the other three fellas had diapers to change and furnaces to clean, and all I had to do was live in a little shack and burn wet green wood. You know, one morning I had my devotions in bed. It was so cold and damp in there. And then I'd ride my motorcycle to work, so they made me their secretary. And I would correspond with Dawson. He sent me a nice Norma pencil, and a great deal. I've got a lot of extra leads if some of you need them. I have extra erasers for your Norma pencil, but Dawson sent me this one. And I used the four colors in Bible marking. Howard Davis, you know, he got a bunch of rubber stamps made so he could mark the margin of his Bible. Then he found out the ink didn't work on India paper. And then he used India ink. He found out that the India ink and the rubber stamps didn't work. So I used the Norma pencil. Well, if reporting the Dunamis Club was a chore, what about the people who graded them and wrote and said, your printing is neat, but you forget to dot your I's? You know, to this day, I appreciate the book of Acts. We started in with that in the fall of 1940, and chapter at a time, we went through there, and that was good. I've taught it to a lot of adult classes and churches since then. Now, I've worried a little bit about that TNT that was on our worksheets and about that dunamis and dynamite bit. Because through the years working in the country places, I've found out a lot of things about the dynamite. You know, we have a lot of jokes about the Lopesians. Those are the folks who live on Lopez Island. And Ray Stedman had a young intern. And a year ago, he sent him up there to be the pastor in the Lopez Island Community Church. And they picked a winner, Ray. Thanks to you. Well, there's a story about this Lopesian, and I'm already worried about Earl Brockway there. He's a famous fisherman in the scaly sense. The neighbors turned this Lopesian in. They said, his smokehouse is going every day, and we're afraid he's getting more than his share of the fish. So the game protector came to him casually. I hear you're getting a lot of fish. Well, some. Could I go with you and see how you do it? Yeah, meet me at my boat out at the point. So they went out, and this fellow had a landing net, little tackle box, and he opened his tackle box and got out a half a stick of stumping powder with a cap and a fuse, lit it, and gave it the deep six. And he dipped up a boat full of fish, half full, and the state game protector was just fuming. He says, you know, we can throw the book at you for this. So he casually lit the fuse on the other stick, handed it to him, says, did you come out here to fish or just visit? Now, one thing that came out of our contacts there on Tuesday nights, I'd met a Christian apprentice and a Christian ship fitter. We began eating our lunch together in the boiler shop. It was a little quieter during lunch hour. And I met Al on a Tuesday night, and the next day he joined us because he was a joiner. He worked in the joiner shop. And the group began to grow. Sailors would sneak up there to our noon meeting. And one day about 1942, we had Kenny Waters give us his testimony. And there were 53 grimy yard workmen and sailors sitting around listening to Ken Waters give his testimony. However, we went into a program of about 15 minutes daily where we shut off everything else except our jaws, and we started in the 1st of January 1941, we started in taking a word or a verse or a phrase from Philippians. We were still there in July, and then we went through Romans that way. Another outgrowth of this was the little white church up in Navy Yard City. They really needed a Sunday school, and one was started there 50 years ago, but the Army moved in and took over the community building, which wasn't much anyway. And ultimately, the people there at Navy Yard City bought a little house, took out the partitions, and started the little white church. We'll be going there in October, and Al and Vanny will, for the 50th anniversary of the Navy Yard City Bible Church. Now, a lot of servicemen attended there, and they would come to meetings at Inglis's home down on Enatai Beach. And Al and I would come home from work there on my motorcycle, and Vanny would have a big pan of brownies for those sailors. And every time Al would say, oh, another cake failure. You haven't forgotten that, I'm sure, Vanny. By the way, I reminded him at breakfast that he was my one and only golfing partner. I played two games of golf with Al, my first game and my last game. And that was Memorial Day in 1941. Well, in 1941, I spent most of the summer working on the Maryland. And in the fall, I attended Life Triumphant. And I heard people and things that I'd never heard before. Stayed at Trotman's home with Lorne Sanny out back. And I rode down there and back on my 39 Harley, and it rained both ways, all the way. But it was on that trip south that I met Evie in October, and about a year later, September 25 in 1942, we were married in a country church at Salem, Oregon, and I have proof of it. You see, it was a double wedding. How many of you were ever married to a twin? You had twins, Ed, when you lived at Mossy Rock. But did you ever marry one? Well, you sure missed a lot. When I introduced her here in 1985, I said that we were incompatible, that I was to provide the income and she was to remain patible. And no. Her parents were godly people who believed the Lord had given them 150 acres of good farmland to raise food for people who had no farmland. And recently the farmland was sold to a marvelous Christian man, and so now my wife can provide the income as well. We lived with Inglises for 3 weeks. I'm sure they've forgotten that, while Evie looked for a place to live. And I don't know where we got it, but we paid $10 earnest money on a house. And nobody else could buy it. Fortunately, we had no phone. They couldn't bug us that way. And everybody wanted to buy that little house, but we had earnest money on it. And I've used this many, many times as an illustration of what it says in Ephesians 1, 13 and 14, that we are sealed by the Spirit of God, which is the earnest of our inheritance until the redemption of the purchased possession. Maybe someone else wants us, but we're his. Now, as I said, not many of you are married to a twin. Her own mother didn't make much provision for her because she didn't know she was coming, and some neighbor ladies rounded up some clothes for twin number two when she was born. I've tried to provide better for her than her mother did. But all of that was good training, you know, for someone who didn't promise to be a pastor's wife, but walked into it unwittingly. Remember, she was in the hospital one time, and her sister-in-law brought her twin sister to visit her, and they brought her a plant, and I was walking out to the parking lot with them, and you know, that head nurse sailed out of her chair like she was jet-propelled, and says, "You haven't been discharged. Get back in that bed." Two years ago, just before we came here, I was asked to bring devotions a couple mornings at the Furs, where David Hocking was speaking at the family conference. And we went to hear him Sunday evening, and the chapel was clear full. And a lady sailed up to my wife and said, "What are you doing with that man?" And her husband, Jerry Wilson, calmed her down a little bit. You see, their son is a good pastor where her sister is the church organist. This is the other twin. He says, "She's married to John." You know, you have to smooth over a lot of things when... Do you want to speak for the rest of the other 9 minutes here? Well, she says the ladies haven't been doing their share here this morning, and she doesn't want to do hers either. We had a daughter born in 1943. She's now in Seattle. And when she was just about 40, she had a little girl named Camilla Marie. That's because her mother was a French teacher, and she's now a church organist and has a fresh floral arranging business in her home. And that little granddaughter was 7 years old on the day I was 70 years old. I can't say too much about her because we have to leave on Saturday, but she sort of replaces our son James Mitchell, who was stillborn, and our daughter Debbie, who died with leukemia. Some of you are anxious to know, maybe. In 1944, my four-year apprenticeship was completed, so I was eligible then to go in the service. And for 13 months, I was on the USS Gilbert Islands. That was CVE 107. And that way, I got to visit a few of the Navigator homes with Harold DeGroff. And I can still remember the first liberty I got out of boot camp. There were some sailors there in San Diego, and they said, "How would you like to go down to church and listen to a guy there? His name is Schaefer." So I heard Dr. Lewis Sperry Schaefer on my first liberty out of boot camp. Now, the Navy gave me $22 a month, but they took away some to send to my wife, and she got $80 a month. And she faithfully tithed $8. She admits that occasionally she borrowed a little from him, but paid him back. And then she made our house payment. And the other $49, I figured out that she bought clothing, groceries, shoes, utilities, gasoline, airmail stamps, one per day, film, and so on and so on. That was good training for the wife of a pastor. There isn't that much in $49, I assure you. And in 1947... after I'd come back to the boiler shop, I was asked to preach in a little town surrounded by Finnish farmers, loggers, gypo sawmills, and I was ordained at Island Lake Bible Camp in 1947. And after a year in the church there, the deacons gave me permission to attend Multnomah School of the Bible and sort of take up where I'd left off at Biola 8 years before. And so I would start out on my motorcycle in the morning, and you'd be surprised how it can rain in that part of the country. And after 10 years in that church, we built a new church there, and after 10 years I resigned, and whereas Navigators were tent making, I was out boiler making. So in 1958 we incorporated the Olalla Bible Church, and we were able to support ourselves there, and the little church is thriving and growing and has been for these many years. We were there about 2.5 years. Then in 1961, we were called to the church up at Orcas Island, a small island which is noted for two things, the tourist season and the feuding season. And we just prayed that our church would be delivered from the feuding season and yet minister to the tourists, which we did for 18 years. If I would see Dr. Mitchell occasionally, he'd say, "John, have you found the red snapper hole down in East Sound Bay?" He loved to go there to fish. And we caught some cod and red snapper, and I only shot one of the pesky deer, and that's because it was a nuisance. But through the years there, I served as a director and the power company, a rural electric co-op, and then I served as a drafted volunteer on the fire department, which meant that, among a lot of other things, and we usually just saved a lot. Once or twice we saved a chimney too, but I don't know why it was. We had a fireman who'd been a fireman in Seattle, and his wife was a nurse. Every time somebody died on their boat or we tried to revive somebody and couldn't, they'd say, "Hey, John, take over, will you?" And they'd had to scoot for home. This nurse and fireman couldn't stand it when the patient died. And naturally, between the sheriff and the fire chief, they would delegate me to go knock on some lady's door and say, "You're a widow now." That was a part of our duty there. And I remember starting at Multnomah School of the Bible, and a young student said, "I'd like to be a pastor someday." But he said, "What would happen if I had to conduct a funeral? Did you ever have a funeral?" Well, I said, "Ask me tomorrow." So I looked in my notebook and I said, I had 30 of them in the last 30 months, average one a month. And you know that through the years I've conducted over 100 wedding ceremonies and I forget how many 100 funerals. But God gave us 18 good years as a pastor there. And I bought a lot, thinking it isn't right to vote here unless we're property owners. And so I drilled a well there 96 feet deep, and we built a little house out there. And when, in the Lord's timing, we were able to sell it, move to the mainland. And for 4 years, I worked for the TV transmitter, doing their wiring and welding and maintaining the vehicles and plowing snow and just generally having a good time making those wheels go around. And the only good thing we ever broadcast from there was the radio Bible class. So necessarily a person wonders what they'll do if they get old and how they will survive. And those 4 years contributed a little bit more to our Social Security than I had ever put in when I made $17 a week. Now, we candidated in various churches, and then the Lord enabled us to sell our house, move to the mainland, and being a tight-fisted Hollander like Corrie Ten Boom, and many of my ancestors who wore Alder Oxfords, they quote Corrie Ten Boom, who said, "Well, we had to rub every copper quite a bit and turn it over twice before we could spend it." And I explained to the man that built our house on the mainland that it really broke my heart to pay 12% interest to him for 21 days. But how glorious that in our old age we could have a house paid for and that we could live among good neighbors. We sometimes think of moving, but the neighbors won't move. A little four-year-old came over to me the other day and he said, "John, you believe in God?" "Sure, Matt." He says, "I believe in God. This is a Roman Catholic family next door, but we're kind of like parents to them." He says, "You know, if you believe in God and you die, he'll make you alive again up in heaven." So it's kind of nice to get a little theology from the four-year-olds next door. And how wonderful it is that the Lord has cared for us as he did. I wish I could tell you more of the people that have been a help to me. Did any of you know Neil Fraser? I guess I'm the only one with those three books, The Grandeur of Golgotha, The Glory of His Rising, and The Gladness of His Return. Well, just when I was most weary, this good old teaching brother, he'd been 42 years with the Plymouth Brethren all over the world. He and his brother-in-law started the Emmaus Bible School. And this dear old brother came around. He could preach better extemporaneously than I could when I was prepared. And what a blessing he was to our church people and to me. And he says, "John, you hear a lot of misnomers. People ask me, is the church going through the tribulation?" And I say, "No, the church is the body of Christ. And a great percentage of that group is already with the Lord. They would have to come back and be resurrected, wouldn't they, to go through the tribulation? And you don't have to agree with him, neither do I. You know, I love to preach on Mother's Day to honor my wife and to honor three women whose names I never found out. There's only one reason that those three girls ever went into the ark. What was it? They were married to their one and only. And how gracious God is. I said we study the book of Acts a lot of times. You get to chapter 8, and here's a descendant of Ham. And he becomes a believer. The gospel furnished for a descendant of Ham. Chapter 9, here's a descendant of Shem, Saul of Tarsus. And the gospel is given to him. In chapter 10, here's a descendant of Japheth, Cornelius, the centurion. And the gospel is given to him. And you look way back centuries to those three women who entered the ark and their faithfulness and God's faithfulness to their descendants. Why? You see the obedience of Philip the evangelist? Did you ever read right through there? Sure, you know Isaiah 53, a lot of you can quote it. But you just unroll his scroll just a little bit further, and what would he have been reading if Philip hadn't run? He would have been reading, "Blessed are the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths." He'd been up to Jerusalem to worship. He would have gone back there to the Queen of Ethiopia as a Jewish proselyte instead of a baptized believer in Christ. Well, folks, my time's up, and now for my hang-up. It's in the language, and I'd like to ask Ed to go to his room for a few minutes. Did you ever get the idea that a smorgasbord was Scandinavian? And then you go up to Expo in Vancouver, and what does it say? Chinese smorgasbord. Well, on the way up to Mount Baker, here's a beautiful sign. It says, "Frozen ice for sale." How many kinds are there? But what bugs me the most, my nephew is a physicist for the Navy in Bremerton. He says, "You should see the sign on the meat market. It says boneless ribs." Would you be here today if there's such a thing as boneless ribs? But, you know what Dr. Mitchell used to say? Just quieten down now, quieten down. When people ask the question, "Where will you spend eternity?" that's kind of a misnomer. It can't be spent. When they talk about being saved for all eternity, there's no end to eternity. What bothers me, and I may have been guilty of it some 30 years ago, but at the communion service, which is supposed to tell you and me that we are one in Christ, that he's the vine and we're the branches, that he's the high priest, we're his kingdom of priests, but specifically when he says that we are members of his body, check with Ray Stedman about body life. Christ is the head. And I wonder, he didn't really come out of the tomb on crutches, did he? But how often have you heard it said, "This is my body, which is broken for you," instead of, as Luke's gospel says, "This is my body, which is given for you." Or some versions which say, "This is my body, which is for you." What does it say in 1 Corinthians? It says that we are one loaf, we are one bread. That's the thing I get out of being here and relating to you some of the people I've met through the Navigator's work. You know, the Jews went to Pilate. And by the way, in John 19, I find four verses where it says, "In order that the scripture might be fulfilled." You know, the same Jews that were clamoring for his death, they went to Pilate and besought him that his legs might be broken because the Sabbath was approaching. And those soldiers didn't break his legs. Not a bone of him was broken. You know, the Word of God says that Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. And to me, he's a perfect type. I mean, the Lamb was a perfect type. I've never figured out yet how those Israelites, I'm not a butcher, but how they slew the lamb and how they put a skewer this way and that way so they could turn it over the first Passover. And there's no question of it being too small. If it's too big, the neighbors could partake with them. But Christ is our Passover, and not a bone of him was broken. The body of Christ is absolute perfection. And I'm reminded of this. Christ is our Passover. He was not the Passover from those Jews. They went and asked Pilate that his legs might be broken, and they were not. And so how wonderful it is that the bread which we break is the communion of the body of Christ, for we being many are one bread and one body. And I've gone over my time a little bit. That isn't all. I went over my wife's time, and she was going to tell you how grateful we are for relatively good health. We took a couple backpacks and went to the bottom of Grand Canyon and climbed out of there in June. Her brother has done this 38 times, lecturing on creation, not evolution. And we were blessed with a good measure of health, and we thank God for it. And to me, it's something precious that this year we can take part in the 50th anniversary of the Navy Yard City Bible Church. A week ago Sunday, I spoke at the 75th anniversary of the Goshen Community Church. And I'll bet not one of you here, maybe not even Evie, could find it. But you know, in June we went to the centennial celebration of the church where she grew up, where her mother led her and her twin sister to the Savior before they could join the church. And that old church existed for 100 years, as far as we know, without a split, without a division. And I went to the present pastor. We had 8 meetings from Friday night to Sunday night. I said, every one of these 8 meetings is excellent. And I'm so narrow-minded, I can see through a keyhole with both eyes. But I said, every meeting you had here is excellent for 3 reasons. You had good music. You had good missionaries. Remember, Eshleman was one of the speakers, always been supported by that church. And then I said, you had good messages. The Word of God was prominent in that church for 100 years. And isn't it great to see that this is going on in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ? Now, somebody asked me what time it is. I'll probably tell them how to build a clock. And I'm sorry I'm over here a little bit, Ken.
Take him up on that. He said you can even dance, but as I recall, if I'm not wrong, in 1 Samuel, the person that danced got despised by his wife for doing that. So probably by others too, I don't know. So I won't do that. And I promise you, Lila, that I won't say any jokes, because Mr. LeCompte has bested me in that department forever. I'm not very humorous. So,
pardon? It's a gift from the Lord. I understand John's, appreciate John.
Yeah, really, really. Yes, it's good. I want to introduce to you a dear sister, Millie Hopkins, and we're going to sing a few choruses. We're going to divide this into 15-minute segments, just, you know, organized that way. And the first 15 will be all these things that Jim said you could do. I'll just brag about her because it said to do that. And I can, you know. One of our elders, who's a psychologist in our church, said, I said to him one day, I said, you know, my wife has just got such good judgment. I said, she should have gone with the FBI. He said, well, she married you, a higher calling. So, and that's true, you know, when I have problems, she's my counselor, my confidant, my lover, my accountant, And I really depend on her. All I do is I'm like Dr. Kenneth Monroe. He said, I have a one-track mind, but at least there's no collisions up there. And that's the way I feel. I sort of get myself into my work for the Lord, and I let Phyllis really run things at home and with the children and all. Not that I don't love them and don't pray for them a lot, but it's just a good fix, a good mix, a good way to in our family to divide it up. And so my hat is off to Phyllis. Brag about your children and grandchildren. We have four children, three girls and a boy. My oldest daughter is an artist in North Central Missouri. My son is a captain for American Airlines. My next to the youngest is the church secretary for a fast-growing church in Richmond, Indiana. And my baby, Pat, she has a business of her own, and she and her husband and two children, live in a farm up on the top of a 157-year-old log cabin, really. And they've refurbished it and all, and you wouldn't believe it. It's a two-story one. Very interesting. So we have a wonderful family. They all know the Lord. Our son needs to walk with the Lord, but he is saved. And we have six grandchildren, two from each of the girls, and two great-grandchildren. I held my latest great-grandchild, Samuel James Millen, in my arms a couple days ago, or the day before we drove in here. It was a great thrill to see our great-grandchildren. Now, how many of you have great-grandchildren? Oh, well, I guess I'm not so much. Lila, do you really? Are you kidding? No? Okay. Well, it's really wonderful. The Lord has blessed us. I want you to know that, even though I'm just a poor preacher. Well, okay. So that's that part. And then it said, preach. What was that? Tell what the Lord has taught you. Okay, now I can do that. The last couple years, we've had some big changes in our church. And you know, I found out something. It wasn't hard to learn, but I had to learn it nevertheless. And it was this, that if you love all the brothers and the sisters, no matter who they are, or maybe if they don't love you, if you really mean that and do it sincerely, God will bless your ministry no matter what. And I found that to be true the last couple years in our church. And it's fulfilling to be able to go up to anybody and put my arm around them and say, well, how are you doing? And we got to do that or we're not good representatives for the Lord. I don't feel that we can hold grudges or things like that at all. Now, it says preach your favorite sermon. That'll come later. And teach. Well, that'll be sort of a teaching too. You know, I met a minister down in Euless, Texas. That's a suburb of Dallas and Fort Worth. And my son goes to that church. His name is Jimmy Draper. And he is an ideal man. He preaches as he teaches. He does it both. He's a deep expositor, but yet he does it with an evangelistic touch. And it's very great to be in his services. When we go down there, we try to go to hear him. Recite a chapter or a book. Well, I've learned the book of Romans by heart, but I don't have it word perfect, and I know Marina would not want me to stop and repeat a chapter of Romans right now, and that would take too much time. But Martin Luther said every one of us should memorize the book of Romans, and though I'm not a Lutheran, I think that Martin Luther was a great man, and I think that's one thing that I feel I want to do is have that down word perfect, because if you have Romans, really, you can go anywhere in the world and get a job and serve the Lord. Okay, pray. Well, we've done that. Give an extended testimony. Now, Phyllis will do that about our lives. No slides. I'm not going to give you any slides, except you saw one of the songs. So I've really done that, too. And sing. Well, we've done that. No dancing. Don't worry, I'm not going to dance Heber. I think of Heber and Alan Inglis and Art and Norma Vaughan and Albert Coleman that I heard talk about his work. And he's a man that's retired to become a missionary. Now, how about that? That's the way I think navigators should act. And then George Swain. Boy, I haven't seen that face in over 50 years. But I remember him from San Diego. I succeeded Dick Hightower in San Diego. Jim Hayden was the director. I was his assistant. And then Phyllis and Torty worked together. And we served the Lord there before Dawson sent us to San Francisco Bay Area to work with the CBMC and Phyllis with the nurses. So, one more thing, your most exalted experience in life and ministry. So, I've got to tell you that. Now, that'll put me over a few minutes, but not much. I want to read you a passage that you may never have thought much about before. It shows, how many of you believe in a second chance? Oh, you don't. Ray doesn't believe in a second chance. Well, we've just got to read this passage to you, all of you then. And I will restore to you the years that the locust hath eaten, and the cankerworm, and the caterpillar, and the palmer worm, my great army which I sent among you. And ye shall eat in plenty, and be satisfied, and praise the name of the Lord your God, that hath dwelt wondrously with you, and my people shall never be ashamed. Well, out at Biola, I think it was my first year, the summer preceding my second year, I was very much misguided. I may have told some of you this, but it'll bear repeating. And I seemed to be misguided and misdirected by the enemy that I wasn't witnessing to enough people. And I burnt the candle at both ends. I went out to Pershing Square. I went all these different places, and I was witnessing for the Lord. And this summer, between the first and second year, I was cleaning rooms at Biola to earn some money. And when I woke up, I was up in the infirmary looking up at the ceiling. And they said I couldn't be moved. I had lobar pneumonia, and they just didn't know for sure what would happen to me. And they got the nurse, Mrs. Susan Claypool, who was a very godly woman. And she came in and knew, diagnosed it right away. And then, so Dawson came up the next day, I think it was, or the day after with Bruce to see me. And then the president of the student men, a man by the name of Chester Padgett, who's now with the Lord, he saw Mr. Hale in the hallway and he said, "How's Dick doing?" And Mr. Hale sort of looked down and he grabbed him by the shoulders and shook him and he said, "He's going to be all right." And he got all the men together and they prayed for me and I came through. And you know, I just think of that and I can almost see a scene in heaven where God is sitting at one side of the table and Satan is sitting on the other side. And Satan tells God what he's done and then he says to God, "Well, I guess I better be going now." And God says, "No, don't go just yet." And he said, "You've forgotten something." And the devil said, "Well, what?" He said, "Well, you've forgotten that I always play the last card. And I'm going to play it now. You've just overplayed your hand. And so I'm going to give Richard a long life and I'm going to give him a fruitful ministry. So your work was in vain." So that was my most memorable experience. And I wanted to share that with you because I'm in perfect health now. I play tennis, I swim, I'm 74, and God gave me my bad physical part at the beginning of life rather than at the end. And I don't take that lightly. I visit in 3 nursing homes every week and do a lot of work like that along with my regular work. So, and I think of what Mr. Hale said one day. I went into his office and said, "You know, I had a good day Sunday." And I said, "Well, what did you do?" He said, "You know," he said, "I go to the sanatorium every Sunday to visit." He said, "I do this as a memorial to my sister who died there." And I guess I took that in my mind and I thought, how wonderful that he had that compassion to go back and do that each week. Well, now I'm going to call on Phyllis to take 15 minutes and I'll leave my watch up here for you, dear. And so you go ahead, and if you can stop around 11:30 or 11:35, that'll be fine.
I'll be able to stop because he took part of my speech all made out here, so it won't be hard at all. You know, it's going to be hard for me to follow this whole thing anyway. These Dutchmen, they have a real sense of humor that I never quite understood all my life. His dad had the same sense of humor as LeCompte did. And so he used to be kidding sometimes when I wasn't sure what he was saying or kidding or what. But it's a certain sense of humor that's just a little different. You know what I'm saying? I'd like to just... Dick last night, first of all, said to me, "Honey, why don't you give a synopsis of our life?" And I said, "All 50 years that we've served the Lord?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Only in 15 minutes? Did you ever try to think through your whole life in 15 minutes?" And so, but I think I can do it because Dick took part of it now. But I'd like to speak to just a little bit of how God has been so faithful. I think all of us could say that. God has just been faithful to us. He promised it and he's done it. And one of the scriptures I said to Dick last night, you know, there's several scriptures about God's faithfulness, but I'm just trying to think. I know it's in the first part of Corinthians. It says God is faithful, but I don't have my King James Version, and I can't find it in the concordance of the NIV. I have it anyway. Because I use NIV most of the time now. But anyway, in the NIV, it's still very, very good. And the verse I'd like to read to you is 1 Corinthians 1. 3-6, I think it is. "He will keep you strong to the end, so that you will be blameless on the day of our Lord Jesus Christ. God, who has called you into fellowship with his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord, is faithful." And he has proven that to Dick and I. I'm not going to go back to before I was a Christian. I didn't become a Christian until I was 17 years old. And at that time, the Lord called... Well, I went to another church just because my mother had become a Christian 2 weeks before. And I went around telling all my girlfriends, "My mother's gone crazy. I don't know what to do. She's crazy. She talks about religion. She's gone to this revival. And something is just, I don't know what to do." And I was heartbroken. But she talked me into going to the service this one night. And when I went... I looked up and this couple that were an evangelist, they were so different than what I pictured Christians to be. They dressed nicely. They told jokes. And I thought, just today we were talking at the breakfast table about this. And they told jokes. And I thought, well, Christians don't have to be so straight-laced and so straight-faced. And so I did watch that. But what I really noticed was the Christians there sang. And I had come from a church that was very formal, and we just really whispered our songs. And here they were singing with smiles on their face. And I can't tell you what the preacher preached. I have no idea. But that night I went forward. Well, as maybe about 3 weeks later, up till then, those 3 weeks, I was at the altar, I'd say, every single night, trying to get something that was missing, and I didn't know what. And they kept saying that you need to be sanctified, you need to be sanctified, and I didn't know what sanctification was. And they never explained it to me, I just needed to be sanctified. So I'd run up the altar again to be sanctified. And who should come to town but this quartet from the West Coast? And you know who was in the quartet, Dawson Trotman. So I went to hear this quartet, and I went up afterwards, and I said to Dawson, "I wish you'd explain to me what sanctification is." And so he sat down with the Bible. That was the first time anybody had sat down with a Bible in their hand. And he started pointing to the scriptures. He said, "Did you do this? Did you do this?" "Yes." He said, "Then you are a child of God. You're a Christian." And he led me into the Word. That was the first that I had really, it had been explained to me what I had done, what the Lord had done for me. And I knew then, from then on, there was no doubt I was a Christian, that the Lord had saved me. Well, Dawson left with his quartet. They were a real blessing to the town. And then Dick came to town shortly after that. And I knew his family, but I didn't know Dick. And he asked for a date. I won't go into details how I really met him, except I took some blankets to his family. And when he asked for a date, I was going with another fellow. He was going with another girl on the West Coast. But he asked for a date, and we went canoeing that afternoon. And I dropped the other fella. I didn't like him anymore. I took one look at this handsome fella and thought, this is it. And so Dick went back, and I don't know whether you realize it, but Doss was quite the matchmaker. There's a lot of us that can say Dawson sort of steered us along the way, but Dick went to Doss and talked to him about me. And Dawson thought I would be good for Dick because I had the sense of humor that Dick liked. And so he thought I would be good for Dick. So that goes back, Dawson, how he's in the beginning he had an influence in our lives. Later, Doss asked if I would come out and help with the Martyrs Club and also go to Biola. I graduated from high school when I was early 17, and I couldn't get a job. There was no way you could get jobs in those days if you graduated at that time. And he thought it'd be good if I just got started at college. And so I had a hard time talking my family into letting me go out so far because people just didn't go away in those days, like from Pennsylvania clear to California to school, and especially when your fellow was out there and you were chasing after him. And so that's what I was doing. I thought, well, it's a great chance. I'll get out there and be with Dick more. So Dick and I, we went together at Biola. Then I went home a year and laid out a year, and then we wrote. I'd say that we went together about 5 years in letters for probably three of those years, going back and forth very fast. And then Dawson was the best man at our wedding. And then I'll have to tell one joke on Dick. He graduated from college at Biola, and he graduated one night. We got married the next day. We left for Big Bear Lake. We were both dead tired. We had a hard time finding our cottage up at Big Bear Lake at night. It was foggy going up there. The next day, the cottage, he had to go down a big steep hill to get some water. He had two buckets, one on each side. He came trotting back up the hill. Not trotting, he came crawling back up the hill. And as he got almost to the top, he stumbled, and the bucket went flying, all the water out of it. And I burst out laughing. I couldn't help it. And he took that one bucket, and he just kicked it. And that was the first time I saw he had a temper. And so I said at that time, I said, boy, on my honeymoon, he kicked the bucket. Well, then I'll just quickly skip over so many little things, but we had, I say, the way we really, our Christian life was so influenced by Dawson and Lila, and also living with them a short time at 509, I don't remember how long, but I know we lived there, watched their lives, and they had a big influence on our marriage, really, because we could watch them in their married life and how they gave themselves over just to the Lord's work, and working for others. And that was seen their motto. In fact, I think they had a motto going down one of the steps that just said others, as I remember it. And that was their motto. And Dawson suggested that we go down to San Diego and work in the San Diego home, as Dick said. And then we were sent up to San Francisco. And I don't know of any other things that... I do want to mention something. When we were in San Francisco, the Lord used them also, how sensitive they were to the work. There were times at San Francisco that the home there was the nurse's home and also the military girls. And we would have times when we needed some money for like rent or food. And one night, I remember especially, we were down praying, just Dick and I. We never wanted to tell anyone of our needs. We just felt that the Lord needed to supply them and tell others of our needs. And I remember we got a telephone call, and it was from, probably Dawson or Lila. I don't know which one called, but was it Lila? I just remember calling and saying, I feel you have a need up there. What is it? And they were so sensitive to the needs of the work. And so we thought, well, this is the Lord's leading, so we better tell them what the need is. And they sent up the money for the rent. So that shows how close the work was in those days. And, you know, that's the one thing in the navigators now. When I see some of the navigators working on campus or back in Indiana, and they don't have that sensitivity and just praying for their needs. They just more, I don't know, it's just so different. And it breaks my heart because I think they're missing the blessing of watching the Lord supply their needs. And I pray for them. And I tell them how those early days We just worked with one another. And then also the fellows down in the San Diego home, many times they would come in off the ships and they would just hand us some money. And little did they know that when they handed us that money, we needed groceries that day. And we'd run out and we'd get the groceries. But it was the Lord supplying through the fellows. But they not only handed money, but they handed ration stamps. Remember the ration stamps? And we couldn't have had all that food if we hadn't had those ration stamps. And then here was little Sally Ann, our little girl. And the fellas just loved her. And they used to go out and buy her dresses and things. I've told the kids how good they were to our kids. And, you know, we can't thank you enough if some of you were at the home at that time and supplying some of these needs. I know the Lord has blessed you for it, but we want to thank you also for all you did for us. Well, then after we were in San Diego, Dawson got a call that... to work with the CBMC and Opening Service Men's Center's NASDIC to do this. And he did go to different ones. I won't go into all the details of different ones. Dick did start. But then he ended up in Tallahassee, Florida. And at that time, we were there probably about a year when Uncle Sam caught up with him and said, "We want you back in the service." And by that time, we had the two kids. And I can remember yet saying goodbye to Dick down there in Tallahassee as he went back into the Navy. And you know, with the thing going on in Iraq now, when Vietnam was going on and we sent our son away, I haven't forgotten the feeling as a mother watching Johnny go to Vietnam. And I would go downtown and I'd walk along the streets and I'd see everyone else just having a great time, not paying any attention to Vietnam War. And I'd think, don't they realize some of us are hurting? And, you know, now with this thing in Iraq, some of these people have had to say goodbye to some of these fellas. And we have a grandson that's in the Air Force now. And I think we should be praying, and we should try to help some of the mothers, some of the wives that are left behind now. They're hurting. And let's really get behind them. We should know what it's like to send off our loved ones to a foreign country. And this is just a little, I'm on this bandwagon right now just because I know what it feels like to send someone overseas, and we should be praying for them. After Dick went away, I went back home and lived with his parents for a while. Dick was in for probably a year because the war ended while he was in. they hurried up and ended it. Here's Dick along back in. Not really. Anyway, we went to Wycliffe at Norman and took a course in linguistics. And while we were there, we met a wonderful Christian man, a giant as far as I'm concerned, as a missionary, Tom Young, who worked in South America Indian Mission. And one night, Dick was studying, and I had already gotten all my lessons, so I wanted to go and see these pictures on South America. And so I went over and I said, and saw the pictures, and the Lord touched my heart, and I said to Dick, when I came back, "Honey, you missed them. I wish you'd go and have a talk with Tom." And so Dick did, and we went down to Brazil. The Lord spoke to him too, and we went down to Brazil to work among the Indians of out of Cuiabá, Mato Grosso, in the Xingu jungle. And while we were there, we had a little girl born, Maureen, who Dick has mentioned now. She is a secretary, but she was born with spina bifida. And at the time, the doctor, when she was born, just said, "Oh, it's just fatty tissue. It isn't anything serious." And so we didn't realize, so she kept being so ill, that anything serious was wrong. And at last, I became ill, and it was my tonsils. And the missionaries there said, "We would like to send you to Dr. Gordon, who is over at Rio Verde. He's a Presbyterian missionary doctor, and have him see exactly what is wrong with you fellows." Well, never realizing that Maureen was this ill, but I did say, "I'll go if I can take Maureen and make sure what's wrong with her." And so we took her, and at that time, when Dr. Gordon looked at her, he just shook his head. He said, "You know, I've worked down here all these years, but I'd never seen a spina bifida before." But he said, "That's what she has. I know nothing really about it." But he said, "I think we need to operate soon." And he said, "I'd be willing to do it. She has a 50-50 chance if I do it. But," he said, "it's up to you." And we decided that he should go ahead and operate. He stayed up all night that night and read books, how to do it. And the next day, while she was on the operating table, the lights went out. The reason was the movie theater in this town, in the interior, where I came on, and they turned off the rest of the town lights. He sent word down in a hurry to get those lights back on so he could finish the operation. But that operation was a success, and it saved Maureen's life. But she didn't really snap out of it because of the bad climate down there. And so our mission board said, this was after we were there 2 years, it would be good if we brought her back home and let someone look at her back here. So we came back. And to show how the Lord is so faithful and how he works and how he guides, it's just wonderful, really. We came back, and we had a friend that worked in the children's hospital in Philadelphia. And he said, you know, I can get her into the hospital in Philadelphia and to a team that's in there. And this team that was there was Dr. Everett Koop. And who worked under him was Dr. Spitz. We had the top that we went to see. And we took her in, and as I was signing Maureen in to the hospital, why, the nurse looked at me and she said, what's your husband's profession? I said, we're missionaries back. And she said, oh. And I said, she's been operated on before by a missionary doctor. And she says, oh, the doctor will be interested in this. And so as we went on down, we got in there, and Dr. Spitz, we told him how the operation had been done down in Brazil. And he kept shaking his head like this, and I didn't know why he was doing it, but he just kept shaking his head like this. And then he looked up, and tears were in his eyes, and he said, you know, I'm a new Christian. I'm a Jew, a born-again Christian. And he said, this has strengthened my faith more than anything else. And so, see, the Lord even guided in that. And he said, if it were my daughter, I would not operate on her. That doctor did a wonderful job down in Brazil. He said if she'd been done back in the States, we could have used different things to hold in this tumor. But he said because he didn't have the equipment down there, but he said he couldn't use the plastic mesh that we use here. But he said it really, as far as I can see, all has been done that can be done right now. He said I would just let it go. But it just shows how the Lord guided again. All the way along, God was guiding. And so then Dick and I, Dick had a church at that time back in Pennsylvania. And I would like to bring out one verse, though, because I think it's so important to show you how trials, sometimes we wonder about them and why God permits them. But, you know, there was a speaker at our church not too long ago, and he says, trials lead to spiritual maturity. And I think of anything that helped me grow, I think Maureen has. Her trial at the time and everything. And yet here's a wonderful verse to bring this out. It says, it was good for me to be afflicted so that I might learn your decree. And that's Psalm 119:71. So it's a good thing when we go through trials. It's a good thing when we're afflicted with all of these. And then dear little Maureen, here she is. She's in her 30s. The Lord has permitted her to grow up and be strong. She's had an operation since in her adulthood. And it's done away with the tumor on the back. They can do that now. That was done in Indianapolis, Indiana. And so much progress has been made since that. But one day she said, you know, Mother, there's a verse in the Bible that's been a blessing to me. And many of you will know this because they're using this a lot today. It says, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. So God knew all about little old Maureen. We didn't realize that she wasn't, that little bone hadn't healed together before she was ever born. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. And the Lord had given her that verse. And she says, so God knew all about it. And he's really given her the peace. In fact, she's, of all the children, I'd say she's the strongest Christian among them. She's the one that is, well, she's so bubbly. Everyone loves Maureen. And she is secretary in this church, and the pastor came to me one day, and he says, we just love Maureen. She just is always bubbling around. And so, you know, really the Lord has just given her a special thing. And then, am I going over? Okay, well then I'm just going to close with a verse in a hurry. I told Dick I couldn't do this in 15 minutes. There was no way I could do it. Anyway, Psalm 138, the Lord will fulfill his purpose for me. Your love endures forever, O Lord. So the Lord will fulfill his purpose in us, won't he?